The podcast you're about to listen to is part of the Professional Casual Network. To find more podcasts like this, please visit ProfessionalCasual.com. This message approved by Throwlash Gaming.
The Professional Casual Network has gear. If you're looking to get some sweet merch from Beard, Jeards, and Skulls, Grim Podcast, A Perilous Adventure, Arachne, and Infinity Podcast, or a whole lot more, you can check out streamlabs.com/ProfessionalCasualNetwork1/merch. Also, don't go to Built Bar anymore. They're not a sponsor and they're dead to us. So head over to monumenthobbies.com and use code ProfessionalCasual at checkout for 5% off every single order you possibly, you know, like, order for like paints and board games and stuff. Right? Thanks.
Hey, my lovely casuals, and welcome to another episode of Beards, Ears, and Skulls, the best hobo podcast on the internet. I'm Taylor, your personal grudge bearer, and I'm a little sniffly, but with me is...
Oh, hi.
That's Stan right there. You can hear him.
It's me.
When he talks. Listen, folks, before we get started, I want to send a huge dowie thank you to our beautiful and wonderful patrons who support us over on patreon.com/professionalcasual. These folks help us do what we do every day, keep the lights on, and keep Tim from eating his Renoas, which I don't think anyone can actually keep Tim from eating his Renoas.
He does like to eat those Renoas.
He's a Renoa eater from way back. Huge special thank you.
Huh? Birth.
Huh?
He's a Renoa eater from birth.
From birth. Berthica.
No.
We have our current big subbies over on patreon.com/professionalcasual of X-Paxis, Iron Maze, Tau, Enmity, Dagna, Briar Mage, Cider Drinker, Kilted Sparky, Kuwaku, Random Guy, Cliff Jumper, Velicenda, Pagan Prince, David, Handsome Andy, Brooks, Chris Dillard, Cord, Bastion, Bangarang, Dravix, Charon, and Cottonmouth MCR. And then we have newest members, Spencer, Ruben, and Nick, which I think I probably said last time, but they're here as well.
No, they're pretty new. I just added them.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, thanks, everybody. Especially, really appreciate that the list has gotten a little longer lately. That's always really nice to see.
Yeah, for real. And it's obviously our doing in this show.
100%.
Like, we cut the show down to every other week, and we almost doubled the amount of big subbies. Like, what a good decision. Correlation 100% means causation.
Oh my god, that's funny.
But you know what has to grow our electric casuals tier?
Can't even.
Tony M, Meerkat, Stefan, Rev, Right Mad, Cliff, Elite Age Showdown was canceled, Anthony, Manuel, the Neil Harris, Lil Willie, Carlos, and the real Nick Barron. Cannon, even. Nick Karen Bannon. Barrett.
Nick. I have no idea what his name is. I honestly don't know which one is correct.
Sorry. I'm sick. Sorry. I actually tried to message him on Discord a little while ago, and I couldn't find him. And I was like, I'm trying. It says the real Nick Cannon. Where is he? Oh, it was the best. I don't even see him anymore. Where'd he go?
You don't even know what you're doing.
I don't have any idea what I'm doing. I really don't. I'm the craziest person I know. Anyways, folks, listen, games played and hobbied. I actually did hobby, and it was for Old World.
What?
I know. It's crazy. Not only did I fix the models that I broke from the real Nick Cannon Baron, most of them. I only have two that need to be fixed now, as opposed to like 20.
That's pretty good. Only two.
Only two as opposed to the 20. So what is that? Like a percentage of them that are done. And then I also put pretty much all of them on bases.
Wow, like the right ones?
The correct ones. Nick Cannon Baron actually sent me bases too.
Whoa, what a gentleman.
Yeah, that guy's pretty dope. I'm going to keep him around. The only thing that I haven't assembled and I haven't touched even is the... Goblin Hewer, just because
Goblin
I need to.
Hewer.
Yes, I need to. I don't know how to assemble that. I need some instructions. So, real Nick Cannon Baron.
Unfortunately,
if you have any instructions, please send them to me. You are so low, I can't hear you. What are you saying?
I said you need to give it better rules.
Oh, yeah, fair, actually. Speaking of that FAQ that made me angry.
Yeah.
There is something in that FAQ. It was the end of January, and I just read through some of it right now. And there was something that I had a joke lined up, Dan. Hang on. Let me see if I can find it.
Your brain's not working so great, huh?
Oh, my God. I'm so tired. Hang on. Here we go. Is there a maximum beyond which characteristics cannot be modified? And it says, unless a rule specifies a maximum, no. And that's wrong. They got that wrong. Because dwarves can't go over Bliss Skill 3.
Oh, you got me with that. I was like... I mean, they have definitely, contradicted themselves. No, okay, he's just so... Oh, that was good. Got me.
You're welcome.
Ooh.
Well, I was queued up for that joke and everything. I was going to have you read that rule.
You make yourself cry.
But so we are not talking about... What's that?
I said, we're so funny.
We're so funny. Oh, what did you games play in Hobby Hobby?
I didn't really games played. I just lost my tab with you in it. I don't know where you went. I tried to minimize double screen.
I'm right here.
Oh, there you are.
I'm right here.
Hi. Hi. I actually have, I know everybody here is going to love hearing this, but I've been doing a lot of Star Wars Legion assembling and building, and I did some painting today. I finally got together all of the clones that we got from AMG. They sent us the starter box.
Yeah.
And the Jedi Knight in general customizable box. And
oh, cool.
Clone marksmen and the commandos.
Uh-huh.
That look, oh, I love the look of clone commandos. So I assembled 60 clones or something like that between all those things and a handful of Jedi. And then I went over to Tim's to give him something, and he gave me a Hondo.
Uh-huh.
Everybody's favorite Weequay pirate. And Jyn Erso, Cassian, and K2SO.
Dang.
And then, what is it, T-47 airspeeder? Uh-huh. Snow speeder? It was a ton of stuff.
Yeah, it's for real.
I mean, the speeder was literally five parts because almost the whole thing is just one piece.
Yep, right. Yeah.
But I just threw paint on that today, and I sprayed it all yesterday. I think it was yesterday. I sprayed all of it. And I painted the speeder today, and it's done except for the basing. I painted the base, but I got to put basing material on it, and then it's done.
It looks real good.
Very exciting.
Folks, join our Discord. You can see all of our progress with stuff and things.
Yeah. I also got, after my Priest of Ulrix did so well against Andy a couple weeks ago, I found in the stuff I bought from my brother, he has 3 mounted Priests of Ulrich.
What?
I knew I had 1 or 2, but I have 3.
Odd number.
he loved Ulrich stuff, so I think he never painted them or anything. But I put that on a horse and put it on the proper base and got that sprayed as well, and I'll get some paint on that soon to go with the priest on foot I have. I'm just going to paint it the same way, because he was pretty great in that game. So he deserves to get painted. Answer.
The Hondo that you got, does he have the Kowakian monkey lizard on his shoulder?
He does.
It's such a good box.
It's such a great model. He's so good. Leaning over. He looks so nonchalant. And then after I was more than halfway done building him, I realized you could build him without his jacket and hat and goggles.
Yeah, but I want the jacket, the hat, and the goggles.
Right. It's kind of cool, but he needs to wear his jacket, hat, and goggles. That's Hondo.
Yeah.
So what's nice is Hondo is a mercenary for any faction.
Yeah, that makes sense.
He works for all of them, because of course he does. Complete sense. It's perfect. Yeah. So I got to get him painted up soon so he can be placed in any army we feel like and do Hondo things.
That's a great way to explain what Hondo do.
If you don't know what Hondo things are, do yourself a favor and just like look up a list of the best episodes of like Clone Wars and Rebels and whatnot to watch with Hondo Onaka. He's also voiced by Winnie the Pooh, which is even better.
When you put it that way. So I think what's funny about that sentence is you could have just said, you know, look up the best episodes of Rebels and Clone Wars, and they have Hondo in them. Like, you know.
Yeah, pretty much. Well, hey, Google, what episodes Clone Wars got Winnie the Pooh?
If you are a Star Wars fan and you haven't watched Clone Wars, though, you're doing it wrong. So
it's either of them. There's definitely some you can cut out.
For sure. Like almost the whole first season.
There are a couple, I wouldn't even say stinkers, just not for everyone type episodes. Like,
yeah,
I don't like the arc with the weird little frog guy that goes off with the droids and it's like four episodes, but some people love that arc.
I completely skipped it. I have never seen it.
Really?
I was like, I'm good. I don't need that.
There's some good moments, but overall I was like, I don't know why I just watched this.
Or maybe that wasn't it. There was one where it was like just a bunch of astromechs. So the whole episode was just beeping.
Yeah.
And I got,
there's like
a
little
know,
green like, dude that's like a general leading them.
Yeah. I got like 5 minutes into it and I was like, I'm done with this. I cannot do this. But
it's like four episodes. It's long.
Skip, 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 skip. But the rest of it's almost the rest of it is incredible. And Rebels is pretty darn good too. But anyways.
It ends very strongly as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it does.
Both of them have great endings. Oh my gosh.
Rebels, not Rebels. The end of Clone Wars still makes me cry. It's so good. Ooh. Ooh. Anyways.
Give them now. Give me the vapors.
Giving me the vapors. We are here to talk about Old World. Duh. Old World. Square bases is what we talk about today. And to start us off. Well, here, pretty much the whole episode's dedicated to Brooks and Brooks adjacent things.
Brooks.
So get ready. We love you, Brooks. Ironweld is a gaming convention that is in Massachusetts. It's in the Sheraton Wakefield, at the Four Points by Sheraton Wakefield, which just sounds so hoity-toity.
Yeah, it
and it's this year, it's from July 10th to July 12th. And like I said, it's in Massachusetts. So we got some time. We got a good like five-ish months. But if you start putting stuff on your calendar right now, you can sign up and go to wickeddicey.com/event/ironweld and sign up for some stuff and things. We will have links in the show notes, including the Ironweld Old World event that I believe Brooks is running. Yep, Brooks is the tournament organizer.
Yeah, go Brooks.
So following the events of the recent Gold Rush in the World Edge Mountains, which I believe was his Everwinter event, fledgling lords set out to find kingdoms while raiders descend upon the recently enriched region. So this is a narrative event composed of 5 rounds over 2 days, which is friggin' awesome. And they are January 11th to January 12th. The event pack is on there. So this is on Best Coast Pairing. If you go to Best Coast Pairings, you do Ironweld, Warhammer, Old World, it'll come up. And the event pack is on here already. So you got months to plan having fun with your stuff and your things. We will go over the Ironweld thing once it gets a little closer. Today is not that day. I just wanted to let you guys know about Ironweld. There are room blocks on this event page as well. But pretty much everything you can find on wickeddicey.com/events/Ironweld. You know what I mean, Vern?
Oh, yeah. The Wicked Dice people know what they're doing. They've been putting on these two events, Ironweld and Everwinter, twice a year for quite a few years now.
And they're
real good.
And they're just good damn good people.
Yeah.
Exactly. They really are.
Like Miles.
Plus,
good dude.
Plus that guy that knows a whole bunch about science and stuff, and he paints on YouTube goes often, and he's cool. Brent? I think his name is Brent.
Oh.
He's friggin' awesome. I sort of kind of met him, but not really. Anyways.
Sort of.
Try maybe next. Huh?
Don't jump back on.
What are you saying?
Don't worry about
it. However, if you want to come play some Old World with us, also in Massachusetts, which I'm not going to say the other one, because if I say the other one, we're going to get this episode taken out. This one's in
Amesbury.
Amesbury, Massachusetts.
Amesbury.
I don't know
how you pronounce it.
This one is in April. It's April 25th in Amesbury, Massachusetts. This is Restorming the Castle. And that's only funny if you have been here long enough to know about the storming of the castle, which was the narrative event that Brooks put on at Bearded Dragon in Oneana. And this is kind of like doing it again, more or less.
We're taking what we learned from that little event with the scenarios, and Brooks has kind of reworked them. We ditched one completely that just didn't really work the way we wanted it to, and he's made up a new one to take its place, and this looks real good.
So the first one that he did was awesome. The scenarios were awesome. There was a what's the flag called? The Union Jack. There was a Union Jack for a map. It was
great. I was like, what's the flag called? A flag? I don't know.
That's called a flag, Taylor, you idiot. And it was great. We had an absolute blast at Bearded Dragon. It was so much fun. And then I loved all the rules that it came up with like siege battles and whatnot. And then he was like, hey, by the way, I can do better. And I was like, well, I don't know if you can do. Oh, my gosh, you absolutely can. And he did. And this is great. So, again, link in the show notes. This is a Best Coast pairing event. If you search Beards, Ears, and Skulls, it'll probably be the first thing that pops up. Or if you want to figure out how to type Restorming, you could put that in there as well. But this is in April 25th. And... just get a little bit of the event details and ready. Once upon a time, everyone thought it was cool to attack a castle in giant siege battles. They were right. In spring of 2025, castles were stormed. Now in spring of 2026, it's time for the Restorming.
Restorming!
So, the Restorming. In this narrative event, players take part in several battles, beginning with an encroaching army scouting an enemy fortification, gathering supplies, and culminating with an assault on castle walls. It's 3 rounds, 2,000 points. And this is just casual narrative fun, not supposed to be a tournament at all. But all the scenarios are on this BCP page, and we're going to go into them. Dan.
Hi.
Read us some stuff, because I talked a lot.
Oh, okay. a couple big things. You said 2,000 points Grand Melee Combined Arms, which is basically the standard anymore. At this point, we're planning on using the current version of the Legacy Renegade Pack from Square Based for your Legacy armies, because for them, especially like Skaven, it makes them playable.
Yeah. Yep.
And they've been, pretty well accepted in the communities, both, locally and that obviously Massachusetts meta area has accepted them quite well. And I feel like generally people think they did a good job with it. I think they may have gone a little bit much with Lizard Men, but mostly because that game I got kind of wrecked by them was, makes me biased.
Fair enough.
He has here, no objective control in games 1 and 2 use modified rules. Players may wish to review those rules when planning their army. See also game 3 deployment rules for limitations on scouting and ambush during that game. Because the idea is you're just going to play the same army each time. It's not like you're switching out armies for each scenario. That very different kind of day you're planning if you're doing all that.
Sure.
Said this is a narrative event for fun. There's no entry price, no prizes, not a tournament. Therefore, scoring will not be tracked. Organizer will use discretion in pairings each round with the intent of everyone having a fun and fair match. Unless your name is Dylan D, in which case we'll look for the least fun matchup possible for you. Because you got to make fun of Dr. D, come on.
What did Speak say the other day? He was like, it's all right, you're not Tim, and you're also not that damn chiropractor.
I missed that one. otherwise, pretty basic stuff. I'm going to go look at the first scenario here called Intel Gathering. The invader moves into the area, its vanguard forces scouting and seeking weaknesses, while the defender moves out, seeking to capture an invader to learn of their plans and thwart their advance. So we've got standard long table edge, 12 inches up deployment, with one objective. It shows it on the deployment line, halfway along the long edge, but it says placement may vary. So this goes for six rounds. Players alternate selecting and placing a total of six terrain pieces. I'll kind of skip over that for now. That's where you can kind of roll and see where they might end up. Deployment.
Well, there is an important piece here. It's each player places one objective marker anywhere along the inside edge of a deployment zone that is not impassable terrain and at least 12 inches from the sides. The objective markers on the edge of a player's deployment zone represent a piece of intelligence,
such as a spy, a key advisor of the army, written plans, etc., appropriate for the opponent's army. Obviously, your orcs and goblins aren't really going to have like a diplomat.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean,
scribbled nonsense.
If they have a diplomat, it's just a pig.
Yeah. It says, note the objective in your opponent's deployment zone is your opponent's objective, regardless of which side players end up on during deployment. After turn setup and objective marker placement, the player should deploy baggage trains if available. Yep. So we're going to have secondary things with baggage trains if both players have that. The last event we went to, we had baggage trains, and it was just I had printed out the right size bases the night before. Was fine. One of these days I need to come up with some kind of like generic baggage train to use for whatever army. I just haven't gotten around to it yet.
Literally looking up STLs right now.
Deployment players roll off, the winner deciding which side they'll deploy on. Players then take turns deploying using alternate method. Typical stuff. Players roll off, winner going first for first turn. And then scenario special rules. This is where it starts to get cool. It says players seek to capture their opponent's objective and get as many of their forces into the opponent's deployment zone as possible. It says no player can move or pick up their own objective. Any unit with unit strength 5 or more that is in base contact with the opposing player's objective and isn't fleeing at the end of the movement phase may pick it up. Should that unit panic, flee, or lose a round of combat, including by giving ground, it immediately moves back 2 inches, drops the objective by placing the marker in the middle of the front of the movement tray, then continues its move. If the unit is unable to move backwards for any reason, such as terrain, the objective is placed as near to the front of the unit as possible. So they're literally going to pick up and carry around the objective within their unit. The unit may stand on top of their own objective, however. If that unit loses a combat, the victorious unit automatically picks the objective up if they are unit strength 5 or more. Should that unit succeed on a roll to restrain or reform, that unit may choose to fall back in good order rather than restrain reform, which I think that's pretty cool. They grab the objective and kind of get make some distance between them and the enemy. Where'd I go? The losing unit does not get to follow up against a unit that falls back in this manner. And then like a sub note here, a victorious unit that picks up an objective in this way may always choose to roll and see if they fall back in good order, even if they are still engaged.
Cool.
Carrying an objective may not fly. So you can't go grab the dragon and fly away.
But my dwarves.
Right? So much fun. Well, they can. And objectives are not battlefield terrain and do not affect line of sight. Imagine them as just basically completely 2D.
Yep.
Kind of like objectives in Marvel Crisis Protocol, where they're there, but not really.
I mean, it's just a people, right? More or less.
It's a people.
Isn't that what we said it was?
It's a people battle boy. What?
The invader moves in the area. Its fingers for a weakness.
So this is a weakness.
While the defender moves, seeking to capture an invader to learn of the plans. Yeah. It's just, or maybe it's like a table. It's in the middle of this random field, they just have a table with a whole bunch of information about like their city.
Yeah, why not?
just stuff. Cool. You got victory points for us, Dad?
Yeah, we do. We get victory points. Ordered as normal for, dead, fled, that kind of stuff. Capturing your opponent's objective is worth an additional 250 victory points and adjust game 3. If the players are using baggage trains, each is worth 100 for the controlling player and 250 for destroying your opponent's baggage train, which I think is normal or slightly more.
Sure.
It might be 250 for destroying. Maybe it's 200 originally. I can't remember off the top of my head. But so it's basically two secondary objectives, or what they call them, strategic locations or strategic objectives.
Right.
Just a little bit more going on where you can pick them up and move them around, which is pretty cool.
I was going to say, yeah, but one of them you can pick up. That's cool.
So pretty simple. It starts without adding too much craziness.
Yeah.
Just a little bit extra.
It starts out with something simple, something easy, right? And what I like about game one is during the setup, each player places an objective marker anywhere along the inside edge of a deployment zone, right?
Ooh.
And then you go for deployment. And you're like, oh, I just gave you a super easy objective.
Here you go.
Right? It's interesting. I like this one. I just sent you a ton of STLs. And by I mean two. One of them is a friggin' dwarf beer cart, and I need it.
big old goats pulling it. I love it.
Why did we not get goat cavern? Anyways, so angry.
Don't even start. You're going to get yourself all upset and flustered.
I can't be upset. I'm sick. So, game two. Game two is you preparing for the siege, right? Sieges are messy affairs, which is very true. They require careful planning, which I'm not good at, and plenty of resources, which I have in abundance, but I don't use them. You better get started on collecting those resources.
Good Lord. He's
trying to yawn. I'm making him laugh.
It's just nonsense.
That's what I do is nonsense. So this is an interesting setup. So you're deploying on the long edges like normal, and then you have like almost this plus sign looking thing of object. My camera is like super.
He got five of them this time.
He got five. One directly in the center, and then two on the center middle of the deployment edge, and then Dan, explain, how does that work? Two move down
what?
24 inches away from them?
Yeah, so yeah. Basically draw a line down the middle of the table.
Yeah.
And you have three spaced out, and then draw a line down the other middle of the table, and you got spaced out. And the one in the middle is the same on both of those threes, so he's only got five.
The problem is it made sense. That was the biggest issue. It made complete sense.
Yeah, like you said, there's five objectives kind of like in a plus sign. Three of them are across that middle line between the two deployment zones. So we got a whole bunch of objectives here because we're trying to prepare.
We're trying to get things, right? So in the setup, players alternate selecting six pieces of terrain like normal, and then you place them anywhere, 6 inches, blah, 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 blah. And then five markers are placed on the board as per the above diagram. Wow. Fish Dan. If the placement will fall upon a piece of impassable terrain, move that terrain the smallest distance necessary for the objective to be placed. Each player places one anywhere along the inside. Oh, anywhere along the inside edge of the deployment zone. So it doesn't have to be a plus. And at least 12 inches from the sides. Yeah.
So five markers placed aboard as per the above diagram. If the placement will fall upon a piece of it. Okay. Yeah, so the one at the top and bottom of the plus sign doesn't have to be right in the middle as long as it's along that line of the deployment zone. You could put it all the way to one side if you wanted to. But the three and across the middle, the horizontal middle, I think they all are there, right?
Yes. Yeah, that makes sense to me.
Taylor's just making a face like he was actively dying. I don't know what. That was interesting.
After you set up your terrain. Oh my God, shut up.
I feel like there's just enough latency today that we just keep cutting each other off.
Oh, my face is purple. Oh. All right, it's my turn now. Thank you. after you set up terrain and objectives, then you put some baggage trains down. That's all I wanted to say. You can keep going now.
Oh, you were talking about this one.
Oh, that's right. Once you're done doing the things you play, you roll off. Winner decides which side they deploy on. Ooh, that's the same. And then players then take turns deploying using the alternate method, starting with the player who won the roll-off. And the first turn, the players roll off again with the winner going first, which is dopers and magopers. Scenario special rules, right? What's that?
I love rolling dice.
Rolling dice. It's my favorite. So in this scenario, players are looking to secure supplies, which will affect game three, right? So kind of culminating all up to game three, which is super duper important. Do so, players must control objectives at the end of the game. Objectives are controlled by any unit that is not fleeing, is within 6 inches of them, and which is carrying a banner. In the event, wait, what? Where's my muso love, Brooks? A banner and a musician.
He does Let's not go. Love musicians.
Well, he's wrong. In the event more than one unit is within 6 inches, the unit closest, if the units are equidistant, then the unit with the highest rank bonus. In the event of a tie, no one controls the objective. So if you play against me, no one controls objectives because I tie everything all the time. So at the end of the game, VPs are awarded per 286. Each objective that a player controls is worth 100 VPs. See game three rules for additional bonus from controlling the objective, right? So you have to remember how many objectives you control in game three. If the players are using baggage trains, they're worth 100, 250 for destroying. So this one is trying to get some supplies. And knowing Brooks, there's going to be dope looking markers on the table because he's incredible.
Yeah. And this is how the dude does. So this is where you're going to want to start to, like, you know, make your list for this event. You want to make sure you've got more than two or three units with banners.
Yep. Yep. Which is going to be great for me because I'm going to play Slayers. So.
Oh, no. I do like that he took away, he didn't make it like the normal secondary objectives where it has to be core units.
Correct. Yeah.
A unit that's not fleeing within 6 inches that has a banner.
Unless you're playing on my table, then you also need a musician.
He's going to lose his mind listening to this. He's going to be like, damn it, Taylor. What up?
So then we culminate to game three, which is the restorming. And there's one part of this that I want to say, and then Dan can take it away, which is A is for mortar.
Go ahead, Dan. For mortar. I love how he's keeping with that ridiculous
bit.
That it goes back quite a ways now.
A year.
Mortar, stupid thing. I don't remember why I said that. but this one is pretty similar to the original Storming of the Castle. We're going to be playing on the short end, like short end to short end this time. And we're going to have a castle wall set up. Roughly halfway across, a little bit towards, not quite the middle, right? 18 plus 14 is how many?
32.
So yeah. Your castle walls are basically in the middle because obviously they're more than, you know, they're a good 6 inches wider. So Brooks have made up a ton of these. They look awesome. He gave me a set of them. They look great to make these walls so you don't have to make, you know, it'll be there. There's 1, 2, 3, 4 wall sections, 2 towers, and a gate in the middle. The attacker starts 14 inches away from the wall. Their deployment zone is 18 inches up from the short edge. And they get 2 siege towers, 2 A mortars. And then in the like defender's side, they get a monument in the middle of their area. And then 2... blacked out sections, it says city. Those are going to be impassable areas because there's a city inside the wall. It's not going to be just empty ground, which I like.
I mean, it shouldn't be.
Right. The whole point is trying to protect people with the wall, right? So again, 6 rounds. It says the game is played on a 6x4 with a wall deployed down the middle. 1 hill and 1 forest should be placed within the attacker's deployment area. And the wall layout is wall, tower, wall, gate, wall, tower, wall, right? Which makes a lot more sense if you see the picture.
Yep.
Which, again, you check out the thing on Best Coast Pairings. And then we have some things from game one result. So if the attacker secured their opponent's intel in game one, they have discovered a weakness in the defenses and may remove one wall piece.
Sappers!
Pretty cool. If the defender secured their opponent's intel in game one, they will be able to sabotage the siege towers and remove one of them. And I like this clarification, it's very important. It's possible for both the attacker and defender to each gain these bonuses.
Dope.
Because, like, theoretically, you shouldn't be playing the person you played in game one, so you both could have won that game it got matched up here. So I like that a lot. So the wall pieces are, what, they're a good 8 to 10 inches long. So removing a piece of wall is a big deal to get units into the city. But losing a siege tower is also a big deal.
And it sounds to me like the attacker gets to choose the wall piece and the defender gets to choose which siege tower, which is pretty nice.
Yeah, I would assume that.
Right.
Yeah, the attacker removes a wall piece. The deployment. Players take turns deploying alternating method. The attacker may place a unit of up to 20 light or heavy infantry inside any siege tower and may reposition the towers within their deployment zone. So you don't get extra distance with that. All other units are placed within the attacker's deployment zone. The defender sets up in the city and may place any infantry or artillery units it desires on the wall. Any artillery set up on the wall may only shoot outside the wall and may not fire at units on the wall or into the city side of the board.
Makes sense.
Scouts for the attacker may deploy on the attacker deployment side of the wall and outside of the deployment zone, if so desired by the attacker. Scouts for the defender may deploy anywhere. No, with normal scout rules. No more than one unit may be placed in ambush by either side. So I like that clarification. You can't scout your scouts into the city. That would be a bit too much.
Yeah. But I do like how you can have an ambushing unit that shows up in the city somehow. I think that is pretty cool.
I like that. That makes more sense in this particular scenario because we've talked about how much risk there is with ambushing.
Yep.
With scouts, it's just boom, they're there. You know, there's no risk at all.
Right. But like, imagine I'm playing ogres and all of a sudden you have to deal with this gorger that just shows up inside the city.
Yeah. You know? That sounds dope. Maybe we'll bring ogres to this.
Yeah, you should.
Need to paint more gorgers.
Right.
All right. So a couple other things here. The attacker receives 2 free mortars, which must be placed within their deployment zone. See below for further details. So I was going to scroll down to that real quick. So this one's the most complex out of all of them by a lot because we've added completely new rules with siege towers and the walls and whatnot.
Yeah.
But like, if you have any experience with previous editions and siege rules, it's basically he more or less took it from previous editions, especially like 6th.
And cleaned it up.
There's quite a bit going on. Luckily, a number of people that, you know, will be there will have done this before.
Right.
All right. So siege towers, they can charge the walls and have movement 7. Units within a siege tower may make a normal charge out of it. A siege tower has toughness 7 wounds and armor of 4+. If a siege tower is reduced to 0 wounds, roll a d6 for each model inside. On a roll of 4+, that model takes a strength 4 AP1 hit. Survivors are placed at the base of the siege tower, which is left in place and blocks line of sight. All of this makes perfect sense to me.
Yep.
Overcomplicating it. Like, there's a unit in the tower. I like the idea that basically the unit is just moving the tower. Movement 7 is pretty generous, but I guess we should clarify, can they march? Because it says they can charge.
So I talked, I put a comment in on this with Brooks, and they are specifically positioned where they are on the map on that line to, even though they can march, they should be able to get a charge off on round 2.
Right, because okay.
Apparently in the first rendition of this, they were just like shot off the board almost immediately or something of the like. So this is like, it's a siege. You know what I mean? Like, they're attacking a castle. They're ready. So you get one march and then you get to charge. Right.
Right.
So they're coming at you, you know,
here they come. Come to America. All right. We got first special rule here is called thud. After completing a charge against the walls, place a small template at the front of the siege tower and on top of the wall. Roll a d6 for each model wholly or partially under the template. On a roll of 4+, that model takes a strength 5 AP1 hit as the door of the tower falls down to allow the infantry to disembark on the wall. with a facing of that player's choosing. A unit that was in the siege tower when it completes this charge against the wall may make an immediate out-of-sequence charge action against an enemy unit on the wall in accordance with the normal charge rules. So that's a long way to say, after the tower, a long way to say, but I think is necessary for clarification. After the tower does the actual charge into the wall, then you place that template as the big door slams down to let the infantry out. Some people might get crushed by that on the wall. And then the unit inside, I like how we specified out of sequence charge action.
Yep. Yep. It makes sense because I know people would be like, well, I mean, the siege tower charged the wall. The unit didn't actually charge my unit. So and it's like, nope, they get to charge now. So deal with it.
Yeah, they're going to count as charging. And I think that's something where we should clarify as well. Like, I would imagine they count as charging as far as the siege tower did, I think, for initiative.
I would say so, but I don't know. That's a good question. Like, do they get their initiative bonus?
I would imagine they've got the momentum of running out of the tower and whatnot. There aren't many. I can't think of any units. Like, I guess unless they have throwing spears, there's not much else that infantry rely on charging for.
Yeah, that's fair.
Especially because it's only regular and heavy infantry. It's not like you've got minotaurs in there with impact hits or anything like that.
Sure.
So I think that's one other thing we should clarify there. Do they get normal charging bonus? Or how far do they count as charging?
Right.
Okay, so, next one here. Oh, you want to do this one?
There's a massive section here on fighting on the walls. And this is, again, massive because it's necessary. Because there's nothing in the rule book that's like this. You know what I mean? Yeah. So infantry can charge up walls are considered being using ladders and it's deemed a disorder charge, right? So it does not apply to units that charge out of the siege towers. So that seems like they're not a disordered charge. I would imagine they get their initiative bonus, but at the same time, if you're charging a siege tower into a wall piece that has a unit on it, it's going to be less than an inch charge. I don't know. Yeah, we'll see. Otherwise, infantry may move on to the top of a wall if there's space for them to be placed. Defenders on the wall should be moved back along the wall where possible to allow for attackers' units to be placed. Where a unit cannot entirely fit after the defender moves back, place as many as possible from the fighting rank on top of the wall, and the rest may be left at the bottom. And fighting on the wall is in close quarters. As a result, units are limited to 5 wide, which, again, I think makes sense, right?
Yeah.
Models on top of the wall, which make ranged attack, have partial cover until the end of the opposing player's next turn. Models on top of the wall, which do not make ranged attack, are considered to have full cover. So if you're making a ranged attack, you have to peek over the wall to shoot. If you're not making ranged attacks, you can just hunker down and use the full cover of the defenses of the wall. What the hell are those things called that come up on the wall piece? I can't remember. Anyways, for avoidance of doubts, models on walls are not considered to be on hills and may not fire in an additional rank unless they are able to do so through some other rule like volley fire. They do have line of sight over non-large enemy units, though, which are not on the walls. So they do have a good line of sight. It's just I would imagine like you're in such cramped quarters, like it's difficult to get more than a few people shooting stuff. A unit that gives ground or fall back in good order moves back along the wall as far as possible, stopping short if another unit blocks its path or it reaches the end of the wall. They do not flee directly center to center with the enemy, but follow the path available along the wall. A unit that flees on the wall moves back along the wall its normal fleeing distance. If it's unable to move its complete flee movement, or its flee movement would bring it into contact with the enemy unit, and instead jumps off the side associated with the controlling player. It's like, nope, screw this, I'm out of here. Each model in the unit rolls a d6 as if fleeing through an enemy unit. 1 through 3, they take a wound. After falling on the wall, the unit continues to flee in the direction directly away from the enemy unit, which caused it to flee. Which, again, I think makes sense. Like, if they're running away from something, they're going to try and run along the wall. And if they can't, and they're still terrified of the thing they're running away from, they're going to jump off the wall. They're like, nope, screw this. This is worth it. I'm getting down from here. And they might.
3 to take a wound is pretty generous for fall damage as well.
Yeah, curtain walls are not small.
Right? This isn't WFRP fall damage. Every model would die if it was WFE fall damage.
Yeah, what is it, like strength for every half inch or something like that for fall damage?
Equivalent here would be every yard is 3 damage, so plus a D10, of course. So those walls are what, at least 5 yards tall, easily.
How tall are curtain walls? 14 feet.
Yeah, 5 yards, close enough.
Roughly.
So they're going to be taking 15 plus D10 damage, which is not good.
Not a good. I'm sorry. Medieval castle curtain walls were typically 20 to 40 feet tall.
All right, let's go in the middle. Say it's 30 feet. That's 10 yards. So that's 30 damage plus D10.
Bruno would just bounce, though. Let's be honest.
A dead character.
That is a dead character.
All right, a bit more about these walls.
Curtain walls is big.
Yeah, real big. Each wall piece is toughness 6 with 8 wounds, armor 5 plus, and a 5 plus ward save to make them a bit different from the siege towers. They're a little bit easier to hurt, but harder to punch through with armor and ward.
Yep.
If a wall piece is destroyed, move each model on it takes strength 5, AP 1 hit. That section of the wall is removed from, like, pick it up, take it off the table. And the survivors are placed on the city side of where the wall section originally was. Models not on that section should be moved towards those on the ground if necessary to maintain unit coherency. Walls block line of sight for units behind them and are considered impassable terrain, excluding the rules for infantry and flying units. Units in the city and on the wall may move on top of the wall and down into the city as normal, provided, however, that charges may only be made down into the city and not onto the wall. So just a bit more clarification on those rules from earlier and what you can do to walls and how you can affect them. Because, you know, if you've got bigger stuff like monsters or monstrous infantry and whatnot, they're going to need you to punch a hole through.
That's kind of the only thing that I'm upset about bringing slayers for is I want big monsters that I can punch holes in walls with.
Then you shouldn't play slayers.
Well, I'm just going to have to use a little. What am I going to use in dwarves then besides cannons? Like, I ain't got no big monsters, Lieutenant Dan.
Very true.
I want a big monster that punches a hole in a wall.
Hey, what's the next bullet point here?
Monsters and war machines.
Look how excited you are.
Well, we did it. They can attack wall pieces in the gate. I don't know if you knew that, but they can do that.
The gate.
Any monster which destroys a section of a wall may move forward 2d6 inches. Should they contact an enemy unit during this move, it's considered a pursuit into a new contact because monsters are so excited about breaking walls down. Man, I might play ogres now.
Oh, man. I don't know if I have enough for both of us.
I don't think you do, no. War machines, which use a template like stone throwers, etc., that target a unit on the wall and then scatter, may scatter onto other units, but cannot hit the wall itself. Alternatively, if a war machine attacks a section of the wall, it is presumed automatically hit without the need to roll for scatter, but still needs to roll to check for misfires as normal. Do not roll for cannon bounces. Turns out cannons just hit walls and stop.
You can't bounce through a wall?
Not in this game, nerd.
I mean, okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's 8 wounds. You're not going to bounce through that. And then we have some flying units here, which may charge units in the wall without making a disorder charge, because it makes sense, and can land on top of the wall. You move the defending unit back as best as able. If a flying unit successfully charged, but there is insufficient room to place the model, it may be placed at the bottom and will be deemed to be in base contact. We don't want to break your minis. You know what I mean?
Don't break them, especially with all the big wings.
Especially those big wings on my gyrocopters with slayers inside of them. Dan?
Maybe I'll bring Empire and finally get my big griffin model painted.
Ooh, there you go.
Big monster.
Dan?
Hi.
Tell us about A is for mortar.
Oh, towers, cannons, and A is for mortars. Towers can be controlled as per the rules on page 275. Tower as in the tower on the wall, not siege towers.
Yep.
The unit in the tower can only be charged by flying creatures or infantry on the wall. So the towers are too tall for the siege towers to charge. You got to get on the wall and then charge a tower from there.
You know, it's a good thing they're not three tall, because then nothing would be able to charge them besides flyers.
Too tall. Each tower is armed with a cannon, which may fire only towards the attacker deployment site of the map by the defender. Remember, only an infantry unit of unit strength 10 or less, or a character whose troop type is infantry, can control a tower. A tower and a section of wall upon which it rests are indestructible.
It's dang.
It's too much to be destructed. I like how he put this, all caps, reminder, because when Taylor and I played this, we completely forgot how that worked and took all of our units too big to even put in towers, so it didn't matter. We know this time. It's a great place to put, like, your unit of 10 archers or whatever.
Yeah, I'm just going to put my Doomseekers in there.
What I are thought they you were attacking attack? Now. You're not yeah. attacking.
No, I'm going to defend, it's not Zufbar. The place.
It could be.
Could be Zufbar.
I like Zufbar. And this good. Is where we get changes based on how things went in game two.
Yeah.
The tower cannons and attackers' mortars do not come with any crew, cannot fight, and cannot be destroyed. Each player starts with 3 shots total for these free artillery pieces, divided between the two of them. For each objective they controlled at the end of game two, they gain an extra shot. Dope, that's new and different this time. Shooting each mortar and cannon requires 1 shot and may be only fired once per turn. Should the cannon or mortar misfire, roll a d6, 1 to 2, the artillery piece is destroyed. 4 to 6, the artillery misfires, just wasting a shot, simplifying that for all these extra pieces of artillery. Those artillery pieces can benefit from nearby engineers who affect misfire rolls measured from the base of the tower to determine if a cannon is within the engineer's range.
Thank you for the disclaimer.
The only thing, my only question here says they don't come with any crew. So you have to have, I feel like this needs a little something, like there should be a unit of your army near it to use it, right?
I would assume, yeah.
Or is it just saying it doesn't come with any crew because they can't be destroyed? Like there's no wound counters to like.
Yeah, we would need a ruling on that. Hey, Master Brooks.
And I know Brooks shared this with us forever ago and asked us to take a look at it, and I just didn't, you know, notice these things until now.
Right. I definitely read the whole thing and I put comments in it.
You did.
Because I'm a good person.
You did a good job.
Thanks, man.
Why don't you tell us about this gate?
So usually my gate is a pretty decent stride. I walk fairly straight. It's not like Keebler. I'm not all limbs and elbows.
What?
No. No.
What is
like
happening?
A gate, like a G-A-I-T gate.
Oh, like anyway. Shaggy. He walks funny. I was not getting that at all.
It's because he's high.
Ooh.
So during the start of turn subphase, the gate may be opened by the defender for their units to leave or enter the city, provided, however, that the gate will not open if there is an attacker within 6 inches of it. They're going to be like, open the gate. And they're like, no, there's a dragon right there.
Man, the gate closes at the time.
Huh?
So I'll never forget the time I was playing Wood Elves in a siege, defending, and my brother was attacking, and I charged mounted Wood Elf guys out of the gate, and he was like, what is happening? And I was like, countercharge.
It's called the Sally Forth, nerd.
And it worked. We're going to Sally.
My name's Sally, and go forth. So a gate closes at the end of the defender's turn. The gate may be attacked and destroyed by monsters and wah machines, and has toughness 7, wound 7, and an arm of 4 up. If destroyed, do not remove that section of the wall. Models can set it to have line of sight through it, and it no longer counts as impassable terrain. Anything can go through the gate. Nor do units on top of that section of the wall fall as with other sections. A monster unit that destroys the gate may make a free move forward up to 2d6 inches should they contact, etc., etc. It's considered pursuit into new combat. Now, what I like about this is it's you didn't actually break that section of the wall. You just broke the metal gate.
Yeah, right? That's the idea. You didn't actually destroy the whole wall.
Right. So I like that. That's cool. Because I don't, a big dumb idiot monster probably won't care and will just destroy the wall. But to simplify it, I like it how it's like, I don't care about anything else. Just get through the gate, right?
Yeah.
Mike Sands.
Yeah, yeah.
And then
yeah.
there's a monument where you can do hobbies.
Oh, monument. I like them.
Like the paint.
I Don't used eat some of their paint. Stuff earlier today.
Heck yeah. Did you paint a speeder with it?
It did. It was almost, mostly them.
So this is actually a shining monument. So it's their metallic line. Statue or inspiring edifice, which is a fun word, which may be controlled under the rules for controlling a special feature, proximity, but has no game effect other than to award victory points because there are enough special rules in this scenario already.
I love that you love that in there.
Victory conditions.
Oh, victory.
Yep, so units award VPs as usual. Each section of a wall destroyed awards the attacker 50 VPs. The player controlling a tower at the end of the game is awarded 200 per tower. So the towers are very important. And it
not
really
siege towers, but towers on the wall.
Towers on the wall. And that really is good to talk about game three, because now you're like, oh, I need like two or three 10 man or less units in my list. Right? So they can take towers. If the gate is destroyed, award the attacker 500. If the gate survives, the defender gets 100. Did I say 500? Anyways, gate. If gate broken, attacker 100. If gate not broken, defender 100.
how many gate points I get?
Google, when I'm restorming castles, how many gate points get attackers?
So stupid.
The player controlling the monument is awarded 100, and the defender is awarded 50 VP for each siege tower it destroys. But you don't get the points if you destroyed them as part of the game one's outcome stuff.
Right, you already got that bonus. Don't get greedy, you jerk.
Oh my gosh, could you get your hands out of everyone else's pot and just work with what you got? Come on,
man.
Get
what you get and you don't throw a fit.
I've read that book to my children. They didn't hear it, but I read it.
They didn't hear it. They were still kids about it.
They were still being children.
Children.
Well, I don't know about you, but I'm feeling 22 and I'm very excited for this scenario. It's going to be great. I'm sure we'll do a whole episode on A, our lists, and then a whole nother episode on B, how the event
bees.
Went. Bees. So I've been lying to you guys for a while. My name is actually Michael, and I'm very afraid of insects. I messed it up. My name is Michael with a B, and I've been afraid of insects my whole life.
Michael with a B. Where's the B?
There's a B.
Yeah, because I was just thinking ogres, and I was like, oh wait, ogres can't go. They can't go in the siege towers
because they're not infantry.
Well, they're not regular or heavy infantry.
Uh huh.
So you'd have to have nobblers in the siege tower. That would absolutely be worth it to paint the 50 nobblers I have to throw 25 nobblers at each siege tower.
Please do it. No, I think it's only 20.
Oh, yeah. I'll take two units of 20 nobblers and throw them in there.
That's hilarious. Please do that.
I don't know if I actually want to paint 40 nobblers, though.
Yeah, but you should. Yeah, and the towers can only be taken by nobblers as well. Oh my gosh, dude, Dan. Get the nobbler list from that White Dwarf.
Ah, White Dwarf 300. Best issue of a magazine ever.
I have it behind me.
You got ankle biters.
Ankle biters. I have two of them. Well, they're past ankle biting. Huh?
You have two copies of issue 300?
No, I have twins.
Oh, you're doing ankle biters. Oh my god. I was not.
Every joke of mine is just yum.
Right? I'm tired. What says the tower says infantry unit strength of 10 or less. So I could put a unit of 3 ogres in there.
Oh, there you go. There you go. Why do I sound like that? Why do I talk like this?
Okay, I kind of want to start making this ogre list now.
So you got to have 40 nobblers.
Easy.
Easy.
I'm pretty sure I've got 50.
I'm actually really excited to see 40 nobblers on the table. I'm not going to lie.
But yeah, but I have to paint nobblers. Nobody wants to do that. All right, let's start with... Okay, we want ogres. I'm not going to make the whole list right now, but it's just kind of fun to start talking about it. We want Renegade and Combined Arms Grand Melee, and this is Restorming Ogring.
Restorming the Ogres.
Restorming, yeah, the Ogres. Oh, it didn't capitalize Ogre for me. Ta-da! Okay, starting with Core. 20 Nobbler Fighters. That's the minimum unit size anyway. Let's throw a Groinbiter in there, because why not? Oops.
Yeah, because it's called a Groinbiter. Like,
that's the champion.
It's the best name.
Okay, so we're 90 points in now with two units of $20.
wait, with 20 or 40?
20. Okay. Two units. Each unit is 45 points because the Groinbiter is 5 points.
Oh my gosh.
He's so expensive. He costs more than two Nobblers.
Is he worth it?
One attack. Why? He doesn't even get more initiative. He doesn't get more leadership. I'm not taking a Groinbiter. I'm gonna save those 10 points. That's a third of an ogre.
Two Groinbiters is equal to a third of an ogre.
Oh my god, that's so good.
Oh man.
Okay. This is going to be a fun list to build. We'll definitely be talking about it on here and in the Discord. We're going to make our siege breaking ogres.
So I got to find these. Like, what's the dilly with Groinbiters? And they have two attacks, and that's it. That's literally it.
Yeah. Why does it cost the same as 2.5 Nobblers? If he had plus one leadership, then I'd be like, okay, worth it. I'll take that. But
yeah, because they have Horde. Like,
but no.
Oh my gosh, dude. Well, here's what it is though. The extra 3 points is the one extra weapon skill strength to attack. That's what it is. You know?
Tim just sent us a link. Somebody clipped. We had an argument on stream the other day where he said I don't remember how it came up. We're talking about Bert and Ernie
from
Sesame Street. And he said that Bert is the official deed owner on their apartment. And I was like, there's no way that's canon. And he looked it up. Hold on. Let me see if we can even. I kind of want to play this so we can hear it real quick.
He would know that.
Right?
He absolutely would know that. Oh my God. Remember when saber tusks were like the greatest thing that ever happened in this game?
I'm assuming you can't hear that.
I cannot hear that now.
Okay, never mind. It's pretty good. Check out the Twitch for that clip. That's good stuff. Yelling about Bert and Ernie. We're weirdos.
Speaking of the Twitch, this has been a fantastic discussion, and I really hope folks come by for this event. This event, again, is Restorming the Castle. It's happening April 25th in Amesbury, Massachusetts.
Yeah.
And the link is in the show notes. If you go to Best Coast and just type in Beards, Ears, and Skulls, it'll show up. It'll probably be the pajamas. Pajamas? Yes.
Commas.
Use the commas.
Ears, comma, and skulls.
I wonder if you just type in beards if in BCP if it comes up.
That I feel like that could be enough.
Right. But anyways, yeah, April 25th, Amesbury, Massachusetts. Be there or be a rectangle. And then am I gonna sneeze?
Bring it.
I sure am.
Hey Taylor.
Yeah.
What sounds like a sneeze and is made of leather?
A shoe.
Good job.
Did you hear that they're going to start making corduroy pillows?
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, there's headlines all over.
It's so dumb. I love it.
So dumb.
I love it.
I got a rumor about butter, actually. You know what? I don't want to spread it.
Okay. No.
Yes. So yeah, Restorming in the Castle, April 25th, 2026, Amesbury, Massachusetts. It's going to be awesome. Dan and I should be there. Brooks is, as well as a bunch of other dope people. If half of the people that showed up to the other thing we went to Brooks's for, it's going to be an incredible, incredible time because those people were really great.
It was a good community. And then there was also Dr. D.
and then so also. I adore that guy, and he's insane. And I mean that in the most loving way possible. Also, don't forget about Iron Weld, which is in July, 10th to the 12th, I think is what I said. Link is also in the show notes there. And if you wanted to hear more about us, professionalcasual.com. We've got all our other socials and podcast blogs, merch, things like Gapapa, the Grim Podcast, A Perilous Adventure is on there. If you don't know what that is, you're doing your life wrong. It's a Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay actual play podcast. It's awesome. And they're up to episode 7,512.
304 just dropped on the Patreon 20 minutes ago.
304. Oh, so was that the thing where I swapped my OnlyFans on accident?
Yeah. No, that was something else.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Oh, no. It would have been last night. Yeah, never mind. I don't know.
Dan's asleep already. Twitch.tv/professionalcasualnetwork if you want to go find that Bert and Bernie debate, because that's what it says.
I just realized, yeah, it says Bert and Bernie, not Bert and Ernie.
Oh, yeah, the prayer phase on Tuesdays, which I don't think we're doing one this coming Tuesday. I think Tim said he had some stuff going on. Dr. D's Disaster Zone, he's streaming all the time, except for right now, because we're recording at a weird time for us.
No, and then not.
I think, I know usually we do it on like Sunday night right before I have to push out.
That's pretty true. Is that or Thursday night, which is what we're doing now, and that's,
yeah,
it's pretty typical.
Thursday works out for me. Thursday, and then Ben, right? Jumps on there and does stuff. Hey, if you want to send Dan and Tim things, please don't send me things. I adore everything that gets sent to me. I really do. I wish I had the time to spend more time with it. And I really do appreciate everything that has been sent. I don't want to make it sound like I don't. But if you want to send Dan and Tim some stuff, because I've gotten enough things, thank you very much. You can send it to P.O. Box G, West Oneonta, New York, 13861. They would really appreciate it. And speaking of sending Tim things, if you want to send Tim pictures of your feet, you can do that to 603-803-3235 and say it's from Dr. D, because he would really appreciate that. Also, hey, reviews would be dope. If you don't mind throwing some reviews our way on either Apple Podcast or Audible Podcast, that'd be super great. Or anywhere is Dopers McGopers.
I never remember to look until we're...
I already looked.
You're going over it. Oh, you did?
Somebody gave us a 2-star review. They didn't give any text about it, but I was like, oh, look at that.
I think
we've
that
got
was
haters.
I think that was back in the beginning when the guy was like, these are just dudes reading the army list saying everything's awesome. And we're like, yeah, because it is, because the game's back. And now we're more critical of it because some things are dumb.
You know what I'm really glad we didn't get into is the cost breakdown that I put in Discord the other day about Cathay. And just
it cost you $800 to have any kind of army.
Yeah, the basics of Cathay. Anyways, thanks for being here, folks. I really appreciate you. Tell Dan that you love him, because Dan needs to hear that you love him all the time.
Thanks,
Dan. You got anything you want to say to the peoples?
Yeah, come to these events and say hi to us while we, you know, dice roll sixes unless it's a leadership test. Got it in there anyway. You thought I wasn't gonna.
I knew you were gonna, you big
No, you didn't.
All right, no. I love you guys.
Love you.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks so much for listening. If you enjoyed this show, check out all the other great shows here at the Professional Casual Network. Like what, Danny?
I'll tell you. On Mondays, we've got the Lost Omens podcast, our Pathfinder 2e actual play, hosted by me, playing through the Extinction Curse AP. Also, streaming on twitch.tv/professionalcasualnetwork at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, you can check out, oh yeah, The Power Phase, our Marvel Crisis Protocol live battle report show. On Tuesdays, the podcast version of Wait, Did I Roll a Wild? Our Marvel Crisis Protocol povlog is available. On Wednesdays, alternating releases on the Patreon, we have Settling the Southlands, our homebrew Wolfthorpe actual play, and The Slithering, a Pathfinder 2nd edition actual play. And on Thursdays, live at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on twitch.tv/professionalcasualnetwork, we've got Wait, Did I Roll a Wild? Our Marvel Crisis Protocol povlog.
You can also check out back episodes of Elite Eight Showdown and the first 39 episodes of the Lost Omens podcast, the first 24 episodes of Settling the Southlands, and the first handful of episodes of The Slithering on the YouTube at youtube.com/theprofessionalcasual.